Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we met the Mendez family, one of the wealthiest families in Western Europe, who rescued thousands of Jews from forced conversion or death at the hands of the Portuguese Inquisition. We followed the de Luna sisters on their own journey east, and watched as the family's wealth slowly drove the two sisters, Beatrice and Brianda, apart. We also learned about the Protestant Reformation, whose effects would ripple throughout Jewish history going forward. This week, we pick up our story where we left off. We will turn back to Italy to see how Jewish life had evolved following the ascension of Pope Paul IV to the papacy, and we'll follow the story of Beatrice and her nephew Joseph in Ottoman Constantinople, witnessing the immense impact they would have on both Jewish and Gentile society. In mid-16th century Italy, a Jewish renaissance was taking place, both in the realms of religion, science, and the arts, and particularly in cities like Ferrara, Mantua, and Venice, where Jews were relatively more accepted in general society. Christian scholars were learning Hebrew, and Jews were mastering Latin and Italian, allowing a crossover of ideas that had not occurred to this degree since the Muslim Renaissance, centuries earlier. Christians would attend Jewish Purim plays called Spiels, and Jews would frequent Christian establishments. Jews were also graduating from medical schools at Padua, Pisa, Siena, and Ferrara, along with Christian colleagues, which allowed them the opportunity to study Latin philosophy, law, and theology from their Christian teachers and friends. As these young Jews began to expand their horizons, many became more willing to blend Latin philosophy with Jewish thought, just as Maimonides had centuries earlier. And this blending, just as it had in Maimonides' time, sometimes divided families and communities, including the Provenzali family of Mantua, one of the most prominent Jewish families in the city. Rabbi Moses Provenzali was fiercely against incorporation of Latin philosophy into the study of Jewish texts, but his brother, Rabbi David, and his nephew Abraham disagreed, going on to found a new school dedicated to this kind of hybrid learning in 1566. At their school, students would study the Talmud, but also learn Latin, rhetoric, astronomy, and math, and pre-med students would be taught by both Christian and Jewish doctors. Simon Schama, in his second volume on Jewish history, puts the existential question plainly. Quote, "Is Judaism a self-sufficient or an open culture? Is it heedless of time or marked by history? Were Torah, Bible, Talmud, and the myriad of interpretive texts obsessively commenting on them and being in turn commented upon enough unto themselves for leading an authentically Jewish life? Is that life necessarily diluted and compromised by immersion in Gentile culture, or deepened and enriched by it?" End quote. One of the early students at the Provenzali school would go on to make another significant contribution to Jewish culture, this time in the field of the arts. His name was Leone di Somi Portalione, but was known to his non-Jewish friends simply as Leone Ebreo, or Leone the Jew. He was born in 1525 and attended the Provenzali school as a young child, where he studied both Jewish and secular subjects. He was an inventive young man, and as a teenager developed a new process for making ink, which would become widely used. But his heart lay in the arts. At the age of 20 years old, he wrote a book called Magen Nashim, The Shield of Women, which was written in a blend of Italian and Hebrew-style poetry, and used both ancient Jewish female heroes and modern-day Jewish heroines as examples of the beauty and strength of the female sex. But it was his next work that truly made him famous, the first ever Hebrew comedy, Tzachot Bedichuta de Kiddushin, a comedy of betrothal. The play made him very famous, a figurehead of the Mantuan Jewish community. He would often use his fame to intervene on behalf of the community, like when he contested the banning of Jews from the silk trade, or supported kosher butchers after they were accused of exploiting Lent to raise prices for Gentiles. In 1562, Leone was the only Jew invited to join the new Accademia degli Invecchiati, a music and art society whose members were all made honorary Italian knights, and thus became the first Jew to ever be knighted. Leone continued to mount and produce plays in his own specific style. He insisted that actors speak naturally, not in a stilted or dramatic fashion. His shows contained musical interludes and dance numbers, and he often served food themed to the performance in an adjoining hall. By 1567, Leone had become known as one of the masters of theater in Mantua, adored by both Jews and Italians. He was exempt from wearing the yellow patch or red hat that all Jews in the kingdom were made to wear, and even members of the royal court would come to see his productions. What made his fame even more notable was the fact that he in no way hid his Jewishness. He refused to mount plays on Shabbat or on any other Jewish holiday. He actively participated in the Jewish community, and in 1585, he used his wealth to build a synagogue in Mantua. But Leone's acceptance by Christian Italians was more the exception than the rule. In 1542, the Roman Inquisition was established by Pope Paul III, and by 1547, it had made its way to Venice. The Roman Inquisition was primarily targeted towards Protestants, however, Jews were often targets as well. In fact, Italian Christians took the view that the only categories that mattered were Christian and non-Christian. They would sometimes even use the term Murano and Lutheran interchangeably. Mantua was one of the few cities where Jews were allowed to live among Gentiles. In May of 1555, a new pope was elected, Pope Paul IV, who was hot-headed, devoutly Catholic, and severely Orthodox, believing that his papacy was portending the mass Jewish conversion to Christianity that would precede the Second Coming. Immediately upon his ascension, he began enacting laws that would separate Jews from Christian society as a means of pressuring them to convert to Christianity. One of his first acts was to put out a papal bull in July of 1555 called Cum Nimis Absurdum, which essentially stripped Jews of all rights in the Holy Roman Empire. They were forbidden from selling food to Christians, from being employed as wet nurses or servants in Christian homes, and Jewish doctors were forbidden from tending to Christian patients. Jews were also made to wear a yellow hat whenever out in public, a law which was not new, but had previously been weakly enforced. I will read you the papal bull verbatim, so you can hear it in Pope Paul's own words. Quote, "Since it is absurd and utterly inconvenient that the Jews, who through their own fault were condemned by God to eternal slavery, can under the pretext that pious Christians must accept them and sustain their habitation, are so ungrateful to Christians, as, instead of thanks for gracious treatment, they return with insult, and among themselves, instead of the slavery which they deserve, they manage to claim superiority. We, who newly learned that these very Jews have insolently invaded our city Rome and a number of the papal states, territories, and domains, their impudence increased so much that they dare not only to live amongst the Christian people, but also in the vicinity of the churches without any difference of dressing, and even that they rent houses in the main streets and squares, buy and hold immovable property, engage maids, nurses, and other Christian servants, and commit other and numerous misdeeds with shame and contempt of the Christian name. Considering that the Church of Rome tolerates these very Jews, evidence of the true Christian faith, and to this end we declare, that they, won over by the piety and kindness of the sea, should at long last recognize their erroneous ways, and should lose no time in seeing the true light of the Catholic faith, and thus to agree that while they persist in their errors, realizing that they are slaves because of their deeds, whereas Christians have been freed through our Lord Jesus Christ, and that it is iniquitous for it to appear that the sons of free women serve the sons of maids." Unquote. That same summer, Paul IV created the first Jewish ghetto of Rome. 4,000 Roman Jews, many whose families had lived in Rome for centuries, were ordered to abandon their homes and move to the ghetto, which was built in a swamp and was just 1 square mile in area. The gates were locked shut at sundown every night, trapping its inhabitants inside until the next morning. The ghetto's Jews were forced to police themselves, could not own any land or property, and could only work as pawnbrokers, moneylenders, and rag sellers. Christians were forbidden from addressing Jews with any formal title, and were discouraged from interacting with them in any way. The creation of the Roman Inquisition and the ascension of Pope Paul IV paved the way for renewed expressions of anti-Jewish hate, including several public burnings of Jews, like the 1556 burning in the city of Ancona. Paul IV died in 1559, just 4 years after his ascension, and was succeeded by Pius IV, who relaxed some of the harshest rules against the Jews, but left the ghetto in place. However, the respite didn't last long. In 1566, Pope Pius V was the next man to ascend the papacy, a man who shared much of Paul IV's vitriol against the Jews. In 1569, he published another papal bull called Hebriorum Gens Sola, expelling Jews from every territory in the papal states, aside from the Roman ghetto and the port city of Ancona. This proclamation paved the way for a series of mass expulsions throughout Italy, including from Milan, Genoa, and Florence. The fleeing Jews primarily migrated to several small towns in Tuscany, where the Grand Duke was somewhat sympathetic to the Jewish cause. But just like the Mendezes and Leone de Somi Portaleone before them, a strange and somewhat hypocritical tension remained between Christian Italian society and the Jews. In general, Jews were viewed by their neighbors as one of two polar opposites, either scum or as a means to an end of the second coming of Jesus. However, there were certain particularly talented Jews who amused some of the most powerful Christians, and for some reason, their talents allowed their Judaism to be overlooked. Examples of these included Abramino Levi dall'Arpa, a Jewish harpist and singer in the 1580s, who was allowed to play at the Duke's parties despite being Jewish, although he eventually converted after his family was tortured in an attempt to blackmail him into conversion. Another example was Abraham Colorni, a Jewish master magician and escapologist who worked in the 1570s as a weapons designer for the Este court and later manufactured gunpowder for the Holy Roman Emperor. Colorni published a famous book on the art of secret codes called Scotografia, which became so well regarded that Napoleon himself had a copy in his library. Let us now turn our attention back to Constantinople, where Beatrice, now calling herself Gracia Nassi, and her daughter had fled in the summer of 1553, attempting to escape the rising Christian ascetism and anti-Jewish hate that was building in Italy. As usual, Gracia's instincts were bang on. Pope Paul IV's papal bull, Cum Nimis Absurdum, was published just 2 years later, and one of the Mendez's trading agents was burned at an auto de fe in Ancona in 1556. But just because she had fled, it didn't mean that Gracia was admitting defeat. To protest the anti-Semitic papal bull, she organized a total Jewish boycott on the city's port. Letters were sent to rabbis across the Ottoman Empire, asking them and their congregations to divert any incoming shipments of goods to Pesaro, a port city that was outside of the Pope's control. Most Jews in the empire decided to join the effort, and the boycott was successful for several years, eventually putting such strain on the Ottoman Empire's economy that Suleiman I sent a letter to the Pope asking him to revoke the papal bull. But not all Jews were comfortable with Gracia's aggressive strategy. The Romaniote in particular felt that this was really a Sephardi fight and were worried about the financial implications of the boycott on themselves personally. This small but vocal minority of Jews opposed to the boycott ultimately led to its failure in 1558. The boycott's failure left Gracia feeling somewhat betrayed by the Romaniote, particularly given her generosity towards them in the preceding years. But regardless of these feelings of betrayal, she continued to fund construction of synagogues across the empire, her only condition being that the synagogues had to be non-denominational, open to all Jews regardless of background, language, or custom. But Gracia and her daughter Reina were not alone in Constantinople. They had been accompanied by João, Gracia's nephew and Reina's cousin, the same boy who was sent to argue her case before the emperor's sister Marie in Brussels, and who had participated in the plot to marry Brianda's daughter in order to protect her from Christian suitors. Upon his arrival in Constantinople, João too reclaimed his Jewish name, Joseph Nassi, and ended up marrying Reina. Joseph settled into Constantinople with remarkable ease and wound up befriending Rustem Pasha, Grand Vizier to the Sultan. And Joseph used this important political connection, along with his Aunt Gracia's fame and fortune, to continue to try and protect Jews wherever he could. For despite the safety of the moment for the Mendezes in Ottoman Constantinople, they, as well as Jews across the world at this time, knew that safety was not a guarantee, particularly in Christian Europe, where Inquisitions continued to burn. And so, in 1560, Joseph and Gracia petitioned the Sultan to lease them a tract of land in the city of Tiberia in Palestine, on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Their goal was to build a new semi-autonomous Jewish city-state that could take in Jews fleeing persecution from across the diaspora. Sultan Suleiman granted the lease, and the two got to work on building their new Jewish community. The city of Tiberia was not chosen by accident. With the expulsion of Jews from much of Christian Europe, Jewish immigration into Ottoman-controlled Palestine had increased since the turn of the 16th century, angering and worrying some of the Bedouin and Arab locals, who feared that the return of Jews to Palestine would portend the end of Islam. This led to growing Muslim resentment towards Jews in Palestine, particularly among those who had supported the Mamluks prior to the Ottoman takeover. But as Jews who had fled the violence in the north began to resettle the area of the Galilee in northern Palestine, it quickly became a center of Kabbalah, or ancient Jewish mysticism. Yosef Caro, a Spanish Jew who had fled Spain in 1492, settled in the city in 1536, which by then was already known as a center for students of the Talmud and Kabbalah. There he published two influential works, the Beit Yosef, a massive tome of commentary on a 13th century code of halakha, or Jewish law, and a distilled version, which he called the Shulchan Aruch, or Set Table, published in 1565, and which went on to become his crowning achievement. Caro's intent with these works was to create an uncontentious standard interpretation of Jewish law for all Jews to follow. The Shulchan Aruch became hugely popular, and Caro is still known to some as the greatest sage of the Jewish people. Caro and his contemporaries attracted droves of young students of Kabbalah to the Galilee, including some who would go on to become stars in their own right. Moses Cordovero, called the Ramak, a student of Caro, was another huge name in Kabbalah, famously an interpreter of dreams and visions, who followed Caro to Sfat and ultimately published a very influential commentary on the Zohar. Following the Ramak was Isaac Luria, a Jerusalem-born mixed Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jew, who moved to Sfat in 1570, where he developed his own system of Kabbalah, which attracted many more pupils and fundamentally influenced the culture and spirituality of Sfat. These prominent Jewish Kabbalists were among the first of the generation of Jewish scholars now known as the Acharonim, or the ones who came after. By the time of Luria's arrival, Sfat was home to nearly 1,000 Kabbalists, who had formed an almost cult-like society. They had built walls around the city to secure it, and had built dozens of synagogues, many with the insides painted baby blue, a symbolic color to Kabbalists. The cult of Kabbalists also had many shared traditions. They would meditate as a group, hoping to catch and ride the celestial chariot into the heavenly realms. They were profoundly messianic, believing that the way Jews reacted to their exile from Spain and Portugal would be crucial in bringing about the coming of the Mashiach. The Ramak started a tradition of walking among the hilltop meadows each Friday evening to greet the Shabbat Queen, a ceremony for which the now famous song Lecha Dodi was ultimately composed by Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz in the 1540s. But Kabbalist culture in Sfat was highly male-dominated. While the men were out praying and studying, the women were working to support the city financially, spinning imported wool from the Balkans into fine fabric. In fact, Sfat became one of the primary suppliers of wool for nearly the entire Ottoman Empire. Other centers of Kabbalah in the Jewish world included Morocco, which largely preserved the ancient Spanish Kabbalic tradition, Italy, where Kabbalah was being infused with European philosophical ideas, and Ottoman Arabia. And so, given Sfat's reputation as a spiritual hub for Kabbalists, Tiberia seemed a natural next step. Gracia sent an emissary, Joseph ibn Adret, to bring money and a note of support to the community, as well as to set up the local government and begin to arrange the city's main economic sector. Just like Sfat, the plan was for Tveria to become a major textile center. So mulberry trees were planted, the favorite food of silkworms, and wool began to be imported from the Balkans. Word was spread of this new Jewish city-state, and European Jews were encouraged to move to the newly established town. In one Italian Jewish community, in the city of Cori, a brochure survives that gives you a sense of the significance of Tveria, or perhaps of the intense marketing it received. Quote, "It is not enough now to enclose us in every place where we dwell, but we have been surrounded with walls, so no man can any longer go forth among his neighbors. The regulations are so strict that we cannot engage in any commerce whatsoever, whether in food or new clothes, nor can we even occupy ourselves with handicrafts. Moreover, the Gentiles are changed against us from sweet to bitter, saying that it is forbidden for them to give us any assistance or domestic help in any way. Now, when the groans and tribulations of the congregation of Cori become great, there came to us the pillar of exile, Lord Don Joseph, in whom God caused us to be given the land of Tveria. We have learned that many have already set out across the seas. We have been told that he seeks Jews who are craftsmen, so they may settle and establish the land on a sound basis. On hearing all this, we became stirred with one heart and went on, as one man, to the synagogue. And there we made an agreement to go dwell beneath the pinions of the Almighty in Tveria." Unquote.
Lecha dodi likrat kala b'nei shabbat nekabela shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad.
Gracia and Joseph were clearly making waves, both in the Jewish and Gentile worlds. But Joseph was just getting started. While Gracia and Joseph were hard at work establishing a new Jewish community in Tveria, there was a struggle ongoing for succession of the Ottoman Empire between the Emperor Suleiman's two sons, Selim II and Bayezid III. Joseph, already being ingratiated into the palace community based on his close friendship with the Grand Vizier, decided to pick a side and joined Team Selim, trying to advocate on his behalf to the Sultan. Ultimately, Joseph's choice was a wise one, as Selim ended up winning the throne after Suleiman died during a battle in Transylvania. Selim viewed Joseph as a true friend and a crucial contributor to his ultimate ascension to the throne, and so bestowed upon him immense power and wealth. Joseph was given free reign of the royal palace, was invited to the Sultan's inner court to advise him and the Grand Vizier on matters of war, the maneuverings of Catholic kings, tactics of the Venetians, and the Ottoman economy. He was given his own palace, called the Palace of Belvedere, just outside of Constantinople, in which he had his own pleasure gardens and scribes who would work on Hebrew manuscripts. But aside from these material gifts, Joseph was also gifted significant power in the empire. First, Selim granted him governorship of the Greek Cyclades islands, including Ios, Mykonos, Naxos, Paros, and Santorini. These were critically important, as they gave Joseph a monopoly over two minerals that were essential in the world of luxury cosmetics. Aluminum oxide, a critical ingredient in the manufacturing of sandpaper, which was in popular use among manicurists, and volcanic pumice, a mineral used as an exfoliant. Furthermore, Joseph also controlled the area of Corinth, known for its alum mining. And he was also given ownership over trade with Poland and Lithuania, from whom the Ottomans procured iron for weapons, grain for food, wax, and honey. But even that wasn't all. Joseph was also given by Selim monopoly over the wine trade in the Ottoman Empire, and he became one of the main exporters of Ottoman wine to Eastern Europe. Although Muslims were forbidden from drinking alcohol, Selim had made the sale and consumption of alcohol legal for non-Muslims in the empire. Beyond this, it was Joseph that Selim trusted to provide his Friday evening meal from his own personal kitchens, the most important meal of the week for the Sultan. The amount of power given to Joseph by Selim made many in the empire uncomfortable, fearing that Joseph had somehow taken advantage of the Sultan or gotten him hooked on wine. But Selim paid the naysayers no mind, and Joseph retained his power and influence. Remember that the alliance that Joseph and the Jews in general had with the Ottomans actually made a good deal of sense. Even though Jews were technically still dhimmi under Ottoman law, they were reasonably well treated and safe, and both they and the Ottomans had a vendetta against the church, the Muslims for religious and political reasons, and the Jews in retribution for their severe and brutal treatment at the hands of the Inquisition. And so, both Jews and Ottomans shared a goal of trying to weaken the church and Christian Europe as much as possible. And Joseph, for his part, used his position within the Ottoman Empire to try to orchestrate the destabilization of the church's influence in Europe. To understand how significant of an influence Joseph had on the European politics of the time, you'll need some quick background on a few key events that were happening at the time. First off, in the latter half of the 16th century, a revolt had sprung up in the Netherlands, a region which had been under Spanish-Austrian Habsburg rule since 1504. The revolt was led by William, Prince of the County of Orange, who both felt that the Dutch deserved independence from Spain and was upset over the severe persecution of Protestants under Habsburg rule. Joseph saw this revolt, which became known as the 80 Years' War, as an opportunity to help weaken the Catholic Church, and Joseph sent word to William to voice his support. Ultimately, the 80 Years' War was successful, allowing the Netherlands to declare independence from Spain in July 1581. At the same time, a second rebellion was occurring in Granada, where Arabic-speaking Moriscos, forced Muslim converts to Christianity, were also rising up against their Spanish rulers, giving Joseph further hope of dismantling the church's power. But the church still held firm in Italy, and there was significant debate among the Ottoman court as to what their empire's relationship with the church should be. Selim's grand vizier felt that there should be a mutual tolerance between the papacy and the Ottoman Empire, especially given threats that the Habsburgs and French had made against the Ottomans in the Mediterranean. But Joseph felt differently and encouraged Selim to wage war against Italy. It didn't take long before Selim was convinced by Joseph, and in 1570, he launched an offensive against the Italians in Cyprus, with the Ottomans eventually winning. This was a huge win for Joseph, and only further inflated his already big ego. And it all started to get to his head, emboldening him to make big moves. In 1569, Joseph had begun to stop French ships in Turkish ports and confiscate their cargo. The combination of Joseph's interference in trade and his significant political power led to a rumor that the campaign against Italy had been launched in order to make Joseph king of Cyprus and to make it a Jewish island kingdom. Selim, who was typically on board with everything Joseph wanted, ultimately had to disavow Joseph's interference with the French ships because of how provocative it was. But by then, it was too late. Joseph had pissed off enough of Christian Europe that an alliance formed between the Papal States, Spain, Venice, Genoa, and various other small Italian provinces, naming themselves the Holy League. In the fall of 1571, the Holy League sent ships to wage war against the Ottomans, ultimately destroying the Ottoman fleet and winning the battle. This catastrophic loss finally turned Selim against Joseph, and upon the Sultan's death in 1574, Joseph lost his political influence. He moved to a new palace in the city of Ortaköy, where he continued his duties as ruler of the Greek islands. He ultimately died in 1579. Outlived by his widow Reina, who was the last matriarch of the Mendez family. But it was not just the Mendezes and the Jewish chief physicians who held sway in the Ottoman court. There was an entire section of the palace and royal court ruled entirely by women. Traditionally, in Ottoman society, the sultans would take slaves as concubines, one of which would ultimately become the sultan's wife. When the sultan died, or when his son took the throne, the wife would inherit a new title, Valide Sultan, the most powerful woman in the Ottoman Empire. The Valide had her own special part of the palace that was designated only for women, called a harem, and would often take on their own projects, building mosques, royal baths, soup kitchens, or hospitals, and sometimes corresponding directly with foreign rulers and ambassadors. In short, the Valides were quite prominent and powerful figures in Ottoman society. But there was a problem. Although Muslim women were technically permitted to control their own finances and engage in their own business projects, they were forbidden from coming into direct contact with men outside of their family. This made the Valides' political and civil roles challenging to perform, unless they had some sort of non-Muslim intermediary who was not bound by the same rules. It was this need of a non-Muslim go-between that birthed the role of Kira, coming from the Greek term for lady. The Kiras were usually Jewish women who would wait on the Valides and ladies of the Ottoman court, helping them conduct business. Over time, the Kiras developed close relationship with the Valides, becoming their confidants and growing quite rich as they profited off portions of the business dealings done on behalf of their Valides. The first known Kira was a Jewish woman named Strongila, who eventually converted to Islam. Her successor was Esther Handali, a woman who remained Jewish throughout her life and ultimately became a confidant and counselor to Sultan Selim's wife. Esther used her power to help her Jewish kin. After a major fire in Constantinople in 1569, she fed and sheltered many of its Jewish victims, helped clothe the Jewish poor, and funded yeshiva scholarships. She died in the 1570s and was replaced by Esperanza Malchi, who became the confidant of Murad III's wife, Safiye. Esperanza became so prominent a figure that she actually wound up corresponding directly with Queen Elizabeth I of England in 1599, in a letter which still survives to this day. She says, quote, "Your Majesty being a lady full of condescension, I venture the following request, namely that there are to be met with in your kingdom distilled waters of every description for the face, as well as odoriferous oils for the hands. Your Majesty would favor me by sending through my hand for my most serene Valide, as being articles for ladies she does not wish them to pass through other hands. Likewise, if there are to be had in your kingdom articles of wool or silk, suitable for so high a lady as my mistress, your Majesty might be pleased to send them, as my mistress will be far more gratified by them than by more valuable objects. I have nothing further to add but to pray God he may give you victory over your enemies, and that your Majesty may be prosperous and happy. From Constantinople, the 16th of November, 1599, your humble Esperanza Malchi." Unquote. Unfortunately, in the year 1600, in the wake of major inflation of Ottoman currency, a group of Ottoman bodyguards revolted and stabbed Esperanza in the chest, blaming her for the economic crisis. They ripped her apart and nailed her body parts to the doors of those whom she had favored with gifts and money. The next day, they set upon her eldest son in the same way. Her younger son converted to Islam to escape a similarly brutal death. Esperanza was the last great Jewish Kira. To end off the episode, let's briefly return to Europe and close out the 16th century there. Remember that from 1290 onward, there had been a wave of expulsions of Jews throughout the continent, beginning in England and France and spreading to Spain, Portugal, the Papal States, and the Czech Republic. It wasn't until the 1570s that Jews began to be readmitted to some of these European countries. In 1567, Prague repealed their ban on Jewish citizenship. In 1574, conversos were permitted to settle in France, though Jews were still forbidden. And in 1589, the Republic of Venice issued a charter granting Jews temporary permission to live there, a permission which would be revisited every 10 years. But Jewish existence remained tenuous in Europe, even while their existence was technically permitted. In the early 17th century, Jews would still occasionally be victims of torture and execution for crimes against the church, particularly in Italy. The ghettos of Venice and Rome persisted, and in 1612, a new Jewish ghetto was created in Mantua, a a city in which the Jews had previously been relatively free. The Venetian ghettos, by the turn of the 17th century, had turned into a rich multicultural tapestry of Jews of various backgrounds. There were Ashkenazim, Sephardim who had fled Spain and Portugal, black Jews from North Africa, who had formerly been slaves, and Jews called Levantines, who were a mix of Romaniote from the Ottoman Empire, Moroccans, and Turkish Jews. Christians often frequented the Venetian ghettos, some to work in the markets, as porters, wet nurses, or in bakeries, and others to hear Jewish music, poetry, and to attend synagogue to hear the rabbi's sermons, which would be delivered in Italian. This Christian-Jewish intermingling within the ghettos was only possible because the Republic of Venice continued to resist the supreme authority of the papacy, although it would eventually fall to the Pope's influence several generations later. But as the decades wore on, hard times fell on the Jews of Italy. In 1630, an Austrian army descended upon the Mantuan Jewish ghetto, slaughtering many of its inhabitants and forcing the rest to flee to Venice. Unfortunately, the overcrowding of the Venetian ghetto caused by this mass influx of Mantuan Jews led to a terrible outbreak of the plague, which itself killed many. Just a few years later, in 1636, there was a prominent arrest of the heads of some of Venice's Jewish criminal gangs, who were involved in fencing stolen property. These arrests caused the whole city of Venice to turn on the Jews, and people began to demand that the Venetian Republic expel all Jews from their lands. The Venetian Jews set out to perform some damage control. In particular, Rabbi Simone Luzzatto published a book to explain Jewish practices to non-Jews, paying special attention to Jewish ethics and moral principles in order to reassure the Gentiles. Luzzatto took his book to the chief magistrate of Venice to make a personal appeal to him not to expel the Jews. And it worked. The Jews of Venice, for the time being, were saved. And that's where we'll end this episode of The Jewish Story. Next week, we will turn our attention to the Far East and Africa and meet some very unique populations of Jews. That's next week on The Jewish Story.